Okay, so the request had been to talk about the meaning of custom at all in a globalized world, and the notion of ethnic identities at all and everything. And I, as I mentioned before, this is one of the topics that I find fascinating, totally underexplored. You know, if I do a PhD, this will be my topic. Hence, the short sheets are a bit long. Not that I'm going to read through all of it, but I figured I'd give you what I have at the moment on the sources. And I honestly, I've been thinking about this for many years, from a halachic level, sociological level. So there's all types of sources in there. Let me lay out the problem. It's just a packet of three shurim I gave in the topic. I taught it over 3 weeks or 4 weeks in Toronto. No, probably more. I think it took me like 6 weeks. Okay, so let's just sort of frame it. Much of halacha is, and halachic authority and halachic practice is in the classical sources, geographic based. We'll look at it from the lens of minhagim, of customs, but it's not just true of customs, it's true of halachic authority, where the classic model of halachic authority is Mara D'Atra. And what does Mara D'Atra mean? Literally, or Mara D'Asra, depending on where you dive in. What does it mean? So it means literally, right? Mara, which is, well, not really, it's master, right? D'Atra
of the place,
exactly, right? The master of the place, right? He's the master of the place, right? Modern Hebrew, this word atar means
website.
Right.
Why do you know that?
Why? I know it. Why do I know that? Because I had a weird Hebrew teacher.
And if you go on a website, now you know when they say it's Ba'atar, it's on the website. And it comes from the Aramaic. So Mara D'Atra was the classic model of rabbinic authority, and it was geographic in nature, literally, Mara D'Atra. Right? It's a sort of a misnomer nowadays when people say that their shul rabbi is the Mara D'Atra. He's not the Mara D'Atra. He's the rabbi of the shul. He's not, unless you only have one shul in the area, or alternatively you have a posek who exercises authority over the entire city, you do not have a Mara D'Atra in the literal sense of that word. Yeah.
Are we saying a Mara D'Atra is like just halakha authority, or like beyond, like almost like a mayor or some sort?
No, in the Gemara this is halachic authority, right? When this phrase is used, it's referring to halachic authority. And many of the halachic models, the assumptions of halacha are geographic. That's just the assumption. And that is not at all the reality. That is just not the reality that we live in. We talk about ourselves being Ashkenazim or Svardim or whatever, you know, Hasidish or Litvish or from Eidut HaMizrach, or take your pick of halachic, Jewish, ethnic identity that we take. It dictates often our practices. It, you know, whether it be kitniot on Pesach or how we rule on different halachic issues, right? We act as if we're Ashkenazim, Sephardim, whatever it might be. But this is really weird. It just is, because that's not how halacha ever worked. Right, halacha didn't work this way. Definitely not in the time of the Gemara. And the question is, how do we get to the point in which we are? Because we live in a very different world. When people 200 years ago talked about being Ashkenazim, what did they usually mean?
They lived in a place
that considered itself Ashkenazi, whatever. They lived in Poland. They lived in, you know, I mean, technically Ashkenaz is Germany, you know, is Germany. But, okay, let's... They meant that they had Eastern European minhagim or something like that, and if people said that they were, you know, Taimani, it was because they lived in Yemen, not because their grandfather or great-grandfather or great-grandparents lived in Yemen, but because they lived in Yemen. And so when they had customs based on the fact that they were Yemenite, it was because they lived in Yemen, and that's what they did in the city. Now, what happened if they moved?
Then they would take on the minhagim.
Then the normal halacha should say that you change your halacha. You moved. Right, if someone moved from Yemen to France or to Poland, So then you would expect, and halacha would dictate this, that they would integrate into the new halachic society. Yeah.
But isn't that weird when you think about, like, Rishonim, like the Rosh, who brought Ashkenaz and Zik tradition into Spain?
So, right, the Rosh is an interesting case, because the Rosh does move, but the question is what exactly happens there, right? There are certain things where he clearly takes local practices and becomes influenced by local Torah culture, and certain things that he brings, and the question there is you do have to divide between custom and halachic traditions. Those aren't exactly the same. I said, right, these are similar models, but not exactly the same. Right, customs, one would guess that the Rosh kept the customs that in the new place while he was there, unless he thought they were halakhically wrong, and then he can make a halakhic argument and change practice. You can do that. So clearly he had studied in a particular halakhic context, and he had those traditions, and that influenced him. There was a dissertation several years ago that was published by a woman, I think at Hebrew U, could have been Bar Ilan, could have been Ben-Gurion, I don't know, but in one of the Israeli universities, who pointed out that with the Rosh, you actually see a shift, that he slowly does shift in terms of his tendencies, in terms of how he learns. The Rosh writes three central works. Who's the Rosh? If not everyone's following, who's the Rosh?
The son of the Torah.
No, father of the Torah. The father of the Torah, right? His name is Rabbeinu Asher. His son, Rabbi Yaakov Balaturim, Yaakov ben Asher. So the Rosh is the last major Rishon in Germany who stays in Germany. The end of the era of the Bali Tosfos in Germany is the Maharam Rutenberg, Rav Meir of Rutenberg, of Rothenberg, okay? Who, Aga, for reasons I'll explain in just a moment, are my wife's favorite Rishon, hence also the name of my oldest son. Meir, yes, I'm not kidding. But my oldest son is Meir after the Maharam Rutenberg, because when Ora and I were dating, maybe first year we were married, we were in a graduate class together in NYU about the Balei Tosfot, and Ora developed an obsession for the Maharam Rutenberg. He's an interesting character. So anyways, the Maharam, right? So Maharam Rutenberg is basically the last major Rishon in Germany, because Germany is collapsing, and anti-Semitism and all that things, and Maharam dies in jail, right, having been captured for ransom and refuses to allow himself to be ransomed because he didn't want the community to be extorted based on the sugyot that say that you can't allow yourself to be ransomed for more than your value because of encouraging subsequent kidnapping. So he has three main students. And the way Professor Ephraim Kanterfogel notes it, his three main students realize what's happening. The writing is on the wall for Germany. So they want to maintain Ashkenazi traditions. So what they do is they all write commentaries on Sephardi halachic works, right? Who are his three main students?
The Rosh.
So one is the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher.
Wait, they're Ashkenazi, but they're writing...
They write their commentaries, they attach it, right, to Sephardi works. The Rosh is technically attached to the Rif, right, to the Perush of Yisrael Fasi. Then you have the Mordechai ben Hillel, which is also written al Seder HaRif, right? And the third is, right, the Hagot Maimoniot, right, who writes his commentary attached to the Rambam. Now the Rosh moves in the middle of this craziness from Germany to Spain. He publishes three works, right? One is the Piskei HaRosh. This is on the Rif. One is the Tosfot Rosh, and one is the Shud HaRosh, right? Is responsa. And so this woman pointed out, and I don't remember her name, Kanterfogel mentioned it in class, that the earliest work he writes is the Tosfot Rosh. He's still living in Germany, and this is written in very Ashkenazi style as Tosfot. Then he writes, I think, the Piskei HaRosh, which is written as a halachic code, which is a much more Sephardi style, though it does record much of the Ashkenazi traditions. His Shuvah are the most Sephardi, right? The ones that are latest. So he does slowly seem to shift. You're right. This is not absolute. And what I will argue is that this shift is not completely new. There are evidence of this in the past, but I want to try to justify it. Yeah.
But also, you said earlier that when there was a battle or whatever, there was an argument between custom and his halachic opinion, like, he would decide, like, what to hit. What
so, right, so halacha can override, right? Meaning,
right,
there are different types of custom.
Are they mutually exclusive?
No, they're not. We're going to have to talk about that a little, right, a bit. Now, custom can mean different things, right? Now, we have to talk about this, but I'll outline a little bit of it. What can custom mean? Right, so sometimes custom means, right?
What you do.
Right, non-halachic. Right, meaning not against halacha, just non-halachic. Right, meaning everyone agrees this is only custom, and it's binding by dint of the fact that it's a custom. Right, to the extent that it's binding, right? This is, sure, kitnio, I guess to a certain extent, you want to give examples, Kabbalah Shabbos, that, right, Kabbalah Shabbat, and no one thinks is halacha, right, to the extent that it's meaningful because of the minag, right, the custom, things like that. Now, there are also things which are sort of sometimes called minag, but they're not really in the classic sense. They sort of blur the line, which is a custom to follow, a particular halachic position, which blurs the line, right, where you do have communities that as a community have accepted a certain halachic position, but as the Rashba notes in a tshuva in if you want to look it up, in Aleph, Reish, Nun, Gimel, the Rashba notes, this is not really, right, this is actually a function of Mar D'Atra, right, the Rashba notes, but it's not really binding 100%. If you had a strong, compelling reason to rule against it, you'd be allowed to. These get blurred. Obviously, they were anti-halachic minhagim. Anti-halachic.
Meaning
minhagim that are wrong, right? But people do them anyways, but this is a reality. Sometimes people say, it's my minhag, right? They mean it's my minhag, even though it's just wrong, right? It just goes against halacha.
Is it valid?
What? So, that's an interesting question, right? This is a bit complicated, because there is a Yerushalmi that says, minhag, Oker halacha, that custom can overrule halacha. The standard psak is that this is only in monetary cases, because monetary cases are subject to custom in a way other things are not. But it's not totally clear. The Gaonim don't really think that. The Gaonim think that if you have a skinny contradiction between the Gemara and Minhag, you actually follow custom, because they claim the reason that the Talmud is binding to begin with is because of custom, and therefore custom really does override. So it gets very complicated. And custom means a lot of different things. Then there are things like, there are two possibilities, not two halakhic positions, but two, like in the Gemara, you have things that are like, there are two valid sanctioned minhagim, and then it's dependent on minhag, which is somewhere in between these. There are all types of different customs, but all of these were geographic. Now, in the 20th century, you basically get a shakeup of this entire system, because suddenly, right, we start primarily, the reason that this really comes into this discussion in the 20th century is because mass immigration for all types of terrible reasons, or good, whatever. Both sort of the ones in the late 19th century, earliest 20th century, pre-war, but obviously to a much greater extent post-Holocaust, where Europe is basically decimated and people move. And suddenly you have a phenomenon that happened much less in other parts of Jewish history, where you have huge groups of people who move and take their traditions with them and recreate communities in America, in Canada, in England, in France, in Israel, obviously, and they maintain their identities. And suddenly, people don't think of themselves, when they think of their halachic practice, as, I live in Modi'in, so obviously I do what they do, right, the customs of Modi'in, they think of themselves as, I go to this Ashkenazi shul, I go to this Sephardi shul, I go to this Taimani shul, I go to this Chabad shul, I go to this Hasidic shtibel, whatever, right, I am whatever I am. And the question is, where does that come from, and is it even legitimate? A similar question, but not exactly identical, but related and necessary to understand it, is if you ask most people where their customs come from, what do they say? My parents. Right? My parents. I do this because my parents do it. That's great, except according to most poskim, there is no such thing. The minhag avot is not a thing. It's not a category. It's not binding. It doesn't exist. And this is not the exclusive view, but actually, as we'll see, the majority view of classic halachic literature. And the notion of parents minhagim is, for many people, the reason that they think they have to keep Ashkenazi Sephardi minhagim is because I'm bound to what my parents did. But that's not clear at all. Yeah.
But it's not being bound to what your parents did. It's being bound to like what you've been doing for many years already.
Good. So that blurs the line. But
the reason that you started doing it doesn't matter because you still.
So it might or might not. If you were under the right impression that you had to keep it because your parents did it, then that, and it turns out that that's not true, which we'll see according to many poskim, that's not true, then that might be a good enough reason for you either to not have to keep it at all or to be allowed to be mater neder, right, and then not keep it. But people don't do that, right? People say, no, I can't do that, I'm bound. I know people who have also, but people usually do it on like a local custom, or if they get married sometimes they'll, you know, sort of be mater neder on their entire way of life, which is what Rabbi Ovadia suggests. Let's start from scratch. Now, related to this, obviously, is the conviction that people have that women must take their husband's minhagim, which is also not nearly as clear as people think that is. Ramosha Feinstein does indeed think that's true. Rav Henkin thinks that's not true, for very compelling reasons.
Isn't there like a halachic position that you're also allowed, like you could both get together and choose your own new minhagim together?
Well, that would be, if you don't think that that you have to take any particular minhag, then obviously, you know, that would be a potential. Okay. So this is just sort of a snapshot of what, right, the complexity of this issue. And like I said, it's the extent to which this has become front and center is much more powerful in the 20th century than it ever was. It's not, as we'll see, there is some precedent to it, and that's where we're going to have to look. There is some precedent to it, right? You have a little bit of this after the expulsion from Spain in 1492. You do have some of this. What I want to do, and I think it's going to take 2 weeks, but like I said, I'm not going to read everything here, but I wanted you to have the sources because, again, I think this is very complicated. I think it's understudied and really grossly misunderstood, which is why I spend so much time thinking about it. But I want you to at least have the sources for what, if you want to follow up on it. That's why, like, I gave you a whole article by Rabbi Lam. I'm not going to read the whole article by Rabbi Lam inside, but I want you to have it in case you want to follow up on it. Okay. So, how do we want to do this? The first question we really need to ask is, well, okay, right? I've made a lot of assertions here that about why this is complicated, namely that the halachic model that minhag was usually based on, halachic traditions were based on, was geography. So first we need to see whether what I just said is true. Is it in fact based on geography? And if it's based on geography, the more subtle question is, was geography the actual halachic relevant factor, or was it a stand-in for something else?
Like what?
So we've talked about this a little bit, but was geography just the normal way that people drew social ties, right? You were part of a community, and that usually was geography. Does that, right? Can we realign that? The evidence we're going to have to look for is to find cases in which someone moves. Can he keep his minhagim? And we're going to have to look at whether family minhagim have halachic legitimacy, because that is a different type of alignment than makom. And if we find that family minhagim do have halachic power, that would indicate that geography is not the only alignment in halacha. If it turns out that geography overpowers family minhagim, or family minhagim are not binding, then it may be that, at least in this category, the issue at hand really is geography per se. Yeah?
But if like social ties are like possibly more valid than like geography, doesn't that validate the idea of keeping your family minhagim?
Sure. Sure, if you take that view, right, that's what that view is going to assume. The question is, does that stand up in the sources? And that's really the question we need to start with. So the first thing we need to do is analyze the original category of minhag ha-makom, which clearly in the Gemara was the the fundamental category of custom. And then we've got to figure out, well, we got to test it. Right? Was min haga makom really, as it sounded like, only binding in a place? Is that really what it was or what it is? So let's, should we break up Chavrusa for a bit here? No one likes breaking up Chavrusa. Okay, fine. So that's fine. So let's, what? Fine. Break up for 5 minutes and read the first three sources. How about that? First three sources. These are just the central source, and I want you to see the first four sources. Okay? First four sources. You know what? I'll make it even easier. Just read source 1 and 4. How about that? Just the two Gemaras. Read the two Gemaras. And if you have time, then read 2 and 3. And if you have time, 5. But start with the Gemaras. 1 and 2. Take 5 minutes, 7 minutes, something like that. Okay, so let us look at some of the sources here. So the central Gemara is this Gemara in Psachim. The fourth parak of Psachim discusses basically entirely customs. The name of the parak is Makom Shenagu. And the Gemara tells you as follows, that ha'olech mimakom she'osin l'makom she'en osin. O mimakom she'en osin l'makom she'osin. So if you go from a place, the Mishnah is talking about several different customs, the custom of working or not working on Erev Pesach. So the general rule in halacha is known nin alav chumrei makom sheyatzah misham v'chumrei makom shalach l'sham. You accept the stringent practices of the place you left and the stringent practices of the place you come to, which, according to the majority of poskim, means only in a case where you are merely traveling, not changing locations. If you change location, you become a member of the new city. But assuming you're traveling, so you have to maintain your local practices, and you cannot break from the stringent practices, right? You can't be going against, right? If the custom where the city you enter to is to not work on the day before Pesach, you can't be the only person working. And you cannot change, you cannot diverge because of dispute. The Gemara, that's right, that was the Mishnah. The Gemara then tells you the following story. B'nei Beishan, Nahu, lo havu azlin mitzur letzidon b'malei shabata. So this is going to be the key phrase we need to understand. The B'nei Beishan had the custom of not traveling from tzur to tzidon, meaning even from too close places, where theoretically there should be no problem of traveling. But even close travel, they would not travel on Friday. So Atu Benayu Kamei Rabbi Yochanan. So the children came, or the Beneihem, let's say, we'll have to define that, came before Rabbi Yochanan, and Amrulo, and they said, and they asked, essentially, can we diverge from this custom? Because they said, Avotein Efshar Lahu, Anan Lav Sharlan, our parents, our predecessors, were capable of keeping this custom. It didn't impose on their life too much. We can't. Amar Lahu, he said to them, Kvar Kiblu Avotechem Aleihem, Shneamar Shma Bini Musar Avicha Valtitosh Tarat Imecha. Said, too bad, your fathers have already accepted this custom. And it says, listen, O children, to the instruction of your, or the rebuke of your father, and do not give up on, do not abandon the teachings of your mother. Okay? This is the central Gemara. Now, if I asked you, based on this, what type of minhag is binding? What does it come down to? What is the ambiguous phrase here? Right? Bineihem, right? Bnei Beishan. Right? All those. Why is this ambiguous?
Because it could mean, like, their kids, or it could mean, like, any descendants.
Well, let's think about it. It's unclear. What is Beishan? Right? What are the two ways of reading this?
Family or a place.
Good. Right? This could either be the people who live in the city, Beishan, Bashan, one of those places. Or it can be the children of a family called Beishan. So either this means children, or this means, right, residents of. And then each time you have ben, you'll have to decide, right, are the parents literally their parents, or does that mean the preceding generations of this city? Now, there are indeed a minority of sources who say, and those are the ones I gave you first, but we'll see that they are the minority, who say that it is, in fact, children. And therefore, the classic models of Minog were, in fact, not just geographic. So if you look, for example, at the Ravid in number 2, the Ravid writes, Im kiblu oto al atzmam livad yicholim habanim l'shan oto, im lo nagu bo acharei mitar avihem, v'in nagu bo kvar kiblu v'shuv ein matir noto v'in nishalin alav. If they accepted it on themselves, so they can no longer change. Now, he doesn't say explicitly that it sounds like family, but in the pre-Toar, he makes it very clear that he thinks the Olam B'nei Beishan, Heim B'nei Mishpachot, Beishan Kipashta. He says this Gemara tells you that the classic model of Minhag is, in fact, family. As in fact, it never was about geography. That wasn't the main category. But as I said, this is the minority view. Why is it minority view? Primarily because we have other Gemara that are very explicit that parental minhagim are not always binding. So if you look at the Gemara in Chulin in number 4, the Gemara tells the following story that Amar Mar Ukva, Anala Hamilta Chala Bar Chamra Legabe Abba. Mar Ukva said, with regard to this matter, I am vinegar, the son of wine, when compared to my father. I mean, my father was great, and I am not. The ilu abba ki have achil bisra ha'idna lo have achil gvina ad lamachar arashta. Because my father would wait
24 hours
between milk and meat. There's your new chumrah, right? Not 6 hours, not 3 hours, not 1 hour, but 24. The ilu ana, I, however, baha sudata hu dilo achilna. I just won't eat them at the same meal. Lisudata achrita achilna, but I'll eat them at a separate meal. And Amar Shmuel says as well, Ana la milta chala bar chamra lagabe abba, I'm also vinegar, the son of wine, compared to my father. Dilu abba v'sar nichse trezimne biyoma v'ana lo sayerno elachad azimna. My father would inspect his property twice a day, I only inspect it once. And many of the poskim noted that in this Gemara it is clear that these people are not bound by their father's customs. Now, if you wanted to defend the notion of parental monogamy, how would you reinterpret the second passage, the second Gemara?
He's still doing the practice, he's just not doing it as frequently.
Maybe, though it sounds pretty clear, like, you know, if someone said, well, I also wait between milk and meat. My parents waited 6 hours and I wait 5 minutes. But, you know, same thing, right? We would not love that. It's positive. Yeah. So maybe you think they're wrong. Okay. So in general, the people who want to push back on this just say maybe it just means that, look, a custom that your parents accepted as a binding practice for generations is in fact binding. That doesn't preclude the possibility the parent will do something but not make it into their minhag, right? It can be that parents do things that they just decide. They only treat as a personal practice and not a family minhag, but something that they indeed felt was a family minhag, maybe that would be binding. And these are basically the two Gemara that are in play. But if you look at the...
What if we just said the like, kind of overall idea of number 4? It's just that you don't really have to follow...
Yeah, that here clearly the sons are not following their parents' minhagim. So the question is that indicative to tell you that this is not an obligation? So if you look at most of the Rishonim, you will discover that the Ravid and the Pre-Toar, who's an Achron already, are in the minority. And the majority understanding of this was, in fact, that the classic category of Minhag is geographic. So if you look, for example, at the Rivash in number 5, quoting from the Ramban, so that's already two big names there, the Ramban writing in Spain, the Rivash writing in North Africa, writes, Elakol b'nei ir b'chlal takanatan v'afanuladim la'achar mikain. All members of the city are within the decree, and even those born later, shereicholim matzibur la'asot takana le'em v'alzaram. A community has the right to make a custom on themselves and their children.
But wait for a minute and see what he thinks children means. The Ramban Zal, the Ramban wrote, it's not only formal decrees that are binding on future generations, but even mere practices. That they accept it to protect the Torah. The children must also follow it. But then at the end he clarifies, what does it mean? Right, what do I mean, children? I don't mean children of a person, I mean, right? Like I say, if you say you're, right, B'nei Yerushalayim, or Ben Yerushalayim, or Ben Chutz Laretz, right? That means you live there, not you're the children of. Ben Chutz Laretz means you are a resident of. In the Chavot Yair, he says even more clearly, and this is brought in the Pitchei Tshuva and Shulchan Aruch, first of all, the pasuk quoted is just an asmachta; it's just a hint. The only type of custom we're talking about are those accepted by a community. And when the Gemara says that people are bound by the customs in Beishan, that was because they lived in a place called Beishan. In the Pitchei Tshuva, on Shulchan Aruch, he writes, "Ein ben mechuyav litnaheg b'hanagat aviv." If you want it clearly, a child is not obligated to follow his father's customs, zulat mashen hitnaheg gama ben me'az shehegdil, unless the son continued to practice it as an adult, then they're bound not because their father did it, but because they did it. And Masha Engin Ben Loet Chilit Aeg Me'olam Kimanaga Tov Shel Aviv. But if the father never, the child rather, never kept the father's custom, so then he's not bound. Now that's Ashkenazi Achronim. Svardi Rishonim Ashkenazi Achronim. Now if you look at the Svardi Achronim on Shulchan Aruch, similarly, the Pri Chadash, Val Kol Panim Adin Pashut. It is obvious, She'ena Ben Chayav Linhok Siyagim Ugderot Aviv Ahud B'nei Beishan, Shnai Yidi Beishan Eino Shem Eichel Shem Makom Da'inu Beit Shan. Obviously, children don't have to follow their parents' Minagim. The Gemara about Beishan is people from Beit Shan, not people who were the children of a person named Beishan. And this is found in Rabbi Bavad Yosef, and it's found in Igrod Moshe, it's found in the Rav Po'alim, it's found in many, many poskim. The Rambam's father, in fact, quoting this pasuk, right, the pasuk that the Gemara seems to derive, thinks that it's about Minhag Yisrael. Right, he uses it for Minhag Yisrael, and he says, "Votama minagon in lanu levazotam umashi inigam zariz umishtadelu kem meikarim nasim levozu minhag ba'uma ukvaramanar via lavashlom altitos torati mecha dot umotech al ta'azov." Right, the Rambam's father said, "What does the pasuk mean that the Gemara invokes for the source of minhag? It means national custom." That is 10. Right, Maimon Avia Rambam.
Okay, but the national custom only makes sense if you lived in a place like Egypt where Judaism was highly centralized. If you live in a place like the States, especially nowadays, like you're not going to get a national custom.
Good. So now let's try to figure this out, right? So we have the classic minhag. We've seen there is a minority voice that thinks that parental minhagim were binding, a majority voice that geographic minhagim were binding. So if I just had that, and then I didn't make any sort of logical leaps, what would you, just on that source, what would you say? In a globalized world, are we now bound by the ethnic minhagim of our parents? What would you say?
No.
No, right? If you just had that, or you would say it comes down to this machloket. Now, to justify the modern practice of basically keeping it as if we still have geographic minhagim, but shifting it to ethnic identity, you could just say, well, maybe, sure, the majority of poskim throughout the generations thought it was geographic, and we think it's about parents. So, for example, that's Rabbi Yashiv.
Well, it's our minhag to think that we follow our parents.
So, good, that's actually, so, Let me hold that thought for 10 seconds. Rabbi Yashiv thinks that we really don't we really do paskins about parents. And he writes this in 11. V'gam yachid shekibel l'asmo hanagat tov, ha'reizim v'chayev et zaro, t'achtiv al tidosh jorari mecha, ala shekol achad eino tzarich, l'ver kol hanagat aviv, ho kmoto rak ma shekibel gam al zaro acharav. But he says, no, an individual must follow the customs that their parents accepted as family minhagim. If a parent chooses to do something themselves and not make it a family minhag, he doesn't, then it's not binding, and that's how he squares the two gemarot. Yeah.
Wait, can I complicate it?
Yeah.
Okay, so what if you had a situation where either your parents are Balei Teshuva or they're in the process of being Balei Teshuva and they haven't had religion in their family for like a number of years?
You want my opinion? You want my opinion or what people will tell you? You want my opinion? They have no binding minhagim at all.
Okay.
They can accept to be part of whatever community they would like, whatever minhagim they like. They are a tabula rasa. That is my intuition. That is my intuition. And indeed, that is, and indeed, that is one of the reasons I don't follow all my father's minhagim, because my parents are both Balei Teshuva, so their minhagim were just developed on what they saw as they were becoming from, but like my father has no firm commitment to these minhagim, and therefore, even within whatever, as we'll see, whatever value there might be to family minhagim on most of these things, it just doesn't exist in my family, and therefore I feel much freer, and things that my wife feels very strongly about, so then we'll just take from her house, or whatever, or things that I have strong halachic positions, I'll take. I don't necessarily take what I did in my house growing up for that reason. That is my intuition. There are many poskim who, even, for example, poskim who think that a wife has to take the husband's minhagim, which again is not something that's at all clear, will say, but if the husband is Baal Teshuva and the wife is not, it's totally legitimate to say, look, you don't have a tradition, I have traditions, let's, right, that is the exception that many poskim will make to the rule, which I'm not convinced is the rule, but fine. Now, you could come up with a very fancy model. Rai Dov Linzer apparently suggested it exactly that way, which is to say, the Minhag America is to treat Minhag Avot as if it exists, right? That the reason we're bound is because there is the international minhag has become to act as if, right, as if ethnic minhagim exists, which maybe is a fair description of the situation, but I'm not sure that that's a halachic statement. It is definitely a fair description, but like, no one throw out minhagim until we're finished with this. Okay, I don't want anyone drawing conclusions yet. Okay. Now, there is a bit of a problem here. Let's say you did think that Minhag HaMakom was the real category and that ethnic Minhagim are Minhag HaMakom and parent Minhagim. You still have the question, which is that people seem to give these Minhagim superpowers and say, well, any other Minhag that you accept in yourself, you could just be Matir Neder, which would make them all evaporate. People don't think you can do that and give up, right? If people could do that with Kitniot, they would all do it, right? But everyone says, no, you can't do it. Why is that true? Even if you think these minhagim are binding, so why can't you just be matir neder, right? Why can't you just nullify the vow? So this is subject to a machloket. If you look at 12 and 13, the Chacham Sofer says, "Megol din nearly ikur ladina din he deim as mechol matir mechol makom b'neim ein lahem heter." The Chacham Sofer has a surprising position that that whatever these minhagim are, once they are binding, the original generation who accepted it can be matir neder because they accepted it, so they can undo their acceptance. But their children, who became bound in it by generational power, cannot undo it because they never accepted it. Which is surprising, but the Prichadash says that's not true. He quotes the Mari Kolon in 13, and he says, "Da'af lavein lo atara v'ader rabbi yesh l'dayim koshgen b'neim yechol nishael alav degriya koach abanim yikoach avim kein l'dazarim shalavot yesh l'matara koshgen l'manim v'zevech svar rashdam." So what are you talking about? If anything, it's the opposite. The people who accepted it, right? The people who accepted it, accepted it. The people who didn't accept it, why can't they get out of it? So that's another complicating factor here. Similarly, the Pri Chadash quotes the Maharashtam that if a particular posek challenges, they can challenge it. We'll skip 14 for a minute. Now, how would we test the possibility that even if geography was the model, how would we test, because maybe there's another model here, right? So far we've set up two models. One is to say that minhag is really all family minhag. That's really the classic model. So obviously you can have minhagim in a globalized world. It was never tied to geography to begin with. The other is to say, no, it was always tied to geography. And we saw that this is the majority view, that it's a geographic category. So if it's geography, so what tweak might you make to a geographic model to say that it is binding? What would you say? Right? Or how would you test it? Right? What would you have to look for? Right? If you want to see whether geography can move, right, what would you look for? Cases where geography moved or people moved. So what is the halacha? What evidence do we have? So if you look at the Pri Chadashim 15, he says as follows: Bnei ir achat shenit garshu v'kavu diratan b'makom acher. This is not the first time people have moved. So what happens if the people in a city are expelled and they move into a new place? Sheish b'em kulot v'chumrot mishunot miminag shalahem. Heyachi nahu migorashin imkiminag mekomam mekominag b'nei makom shekavu diratan. Right, he asked this question. Right, you have a entire community that picks up and moves to a new city. Do they keep their old minhagim?
The entire community?
Whole community picks up and moves.
Which,
right?
Which
this is 15. Bottom of the first page. Right? A whole city moves. This happens, right? After the expulsion, whole communities moved from Spain to Amsterdam, to right, South America. So, he's really asking this question. Is there ever a time when a community can maintain its geographic identity in a new geography? Right, that's the question you have to answer if you want to accept that geography was the classic model of minhag, but you're now in a globalized world. So what does he say? So he says, "Kol ir chadasha im noda rov ansha meichan ba'u akol k'minhag oto amakom sheba'u misham adkan l'shono." He said, "Well, it depends. The time it davi ir chadasha." He said, "If they move to a tabula rasa." They move to a place where there is no minhag, then in that limited circumstance, he thinks that you can recreate geography.
Wait, right? What does that mean, recreate
geography? Meaning, you can take a community that was in France, was in Paris, and if they move to the middle of
Pakistan,
Wyoming, and there's no Jews in the area, they can act as if they're still in Paris and move the minhagim with them. Okay?
Yeah.
Is that the reality we're talking about? No, that's not the reality we're talking about. So what if they move into a place where there were Jews? Yeah.
Well, what if there's a minority or a majority situation?
Good, so that's what he says.
A
majority moves to a place where there's like a people. Good, so that's exactly what he says. Avalim halchu le'ir echad sheish b'minyan. Avo pisha ba'im hei merubim. Top of the second page, he said, let's say 1 million people move into a city and there are 10 Jews there. So what's the halacha?
10 Jews.
The million Jews cannot bring them in Hagim with them. They must give in to the minhag of the 10 because they moved into a new place and that place had a minhag. That is the position of Rechadash. Yesh lam din yachid v'chayv lanok kumrei makom shalchu misham v'paku minayu achumrod shayinu na'agu bimkoman. They now have to accept the stringencies of the new place and all their prior commitments evaporate into thin air. Now, according to that model, what customs should all American Jews be keeping? Spanish Portuguese. We do know. We know the earliest Jews in America were all Spanish Portuguese communities.
All American Jews. You're assuming all of America is one community.
Right.
Fine. All New Yorkers. Fine.
Okay.
New York. All in Manhattan, at least. Okay.
Okay,
right. Manhattan. But to be fair, all the early Jews. And by the way, if any of you ever read Jonathan Sarna's History of Jews of America or whatever it's called, American Judaism, whatever, it's the history of the Jews in America, whatever it's called. You will see that actually Spanish Portuguese community actually believed that. They really felt that anyone who moved in had to follow their customs, and they were furious when people came in and tried to bring in Ashkenazi minhagim, and there was a lot of fights in New York about setting up kihilot, and no one was happy with anybody, and it was very, very complicated. It's fascinating, in the history of kashrut, as it reflected itself through that, Erevin, all types of things were manifest in this. But the Pri Chadash argues that it really is geographic. And if a whole, million people move and there's a community of 10 people, so too bad. The geography keeps right? It determines you move into a new place, it has a milah, that's it. When you have models like that in Poskim, right, you look at what we have and you say, how did we get here? Right? Because it seems here's a very nice test case, right? A million people move in to a town with 10 people. If Minhag was not about geography, it was just a stand-in for identity or social ties or ethnic community, then you would say, okay, in a case like that, a million, either you'd have two possibilities. Either the million overpower the 10, and the 10 have to accept their Minhag, or it's legitimate for both of them to keep their own Minhagim. But neither of those are the classic halakhic positions. The position is the million have to accept the customs of the 10. Yeah.
Can you just define ethnic?
I mean Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Temani. I mean, like, right? People who define themselves for halakhic practice based on their country of origin.
Okay.
Right? Meaning, am I in any way, shape, or form Ashkenazi? Am I Lithuanian? No. Like, my parent, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, like, my great-grandparents moved to New York in the 1890s or 1880s. Right, what connection do I have to those? My mother's side, my mother's from Israel. Like, why am I in any way, shape, or form Ashkenazi? In what sense am I Ashkenazi? I'm a New Yorker, right? And yet, right, people look at me and say, oh, you can't eat kidney on Pesach. Why can't I eat kidney on Pesach? That's the minhag of New York, right? That's the minhag of Israel. It's neither the minhag of, right, Cologne, where my mother was born, nor, you know, my family has been in the five boroughs for 120 years, right? What connection do I have to some minhag Ashkenaz? But people look at me and say, you're Ashkenazi. What does it mean, Ashkenazi? Well, you know, your family's from Eastern Europe. Okay, right? So what? Right? But we'll say, no, you're Ashkenazi. You have an identity, right? You have... And they'll say, oh, we love these... I mean, think about it, right? In Israel, we do this all the time, right? Where you just went and you watch the celebration, right? The celebrations of... How do you pronounce it? Sigd, right? And people will say, look, isn't it beautiful? The Ethiopian community kept its minhagim. But honestly, let's look halachically, right? We would wonder, well, why... I'm not picking on them. I'm just saying, right? Right? Well, why? Well, they're not in Ethiopia. Why should they keep the minhag? Right? But it's not just them. We all do this, right?
Some of them are olim. Like, I think it's different for us because some of... Like, we are not... necessarily.
Okay, fine, but still, the point. My point is halachically, right? Is that we act as a community as if this means something. That hey, this is great. They keep their minhagim, Ashkenazim. We keep our minhagim, Sephardim. We keep our minhagim. Right? Everyone keeps their minhagim. It's beautiful. We have this nice mosaic, right? We have this nice mosaic. But if you look at the classic sources, where's this come from? Right? You think that you went into a community 800 years ago, and they would be celebrating the mosaic of customs? Are you crazy? Right? You walked into a place, you kept what the custom was. Don't, right? Don't be an upstart. And again, the Brichader says that's even if a million people move in. So the classic halachic models force you to ask, what is going on? Yeah.
The whole thing about, like, you said that even if a million Jews move to a place of 10 Jews, is that like an authoritative position just because it's written?
I mean, this was... Correct, but it is the... Well, this is really the question I'm asking, is this is the majority view. This is the view we'll find in pretty much all the classic sources. So, what happened? Right? Meaning, this is really the question I'm asking, is, you're right, it might be that this is what everyone said and maybe we rolled differently, but you know, but no one ever... But when did that happen? Meaning, the traditional halakhic literature is all pointing the direction, this is not a legitimate model. Right, this identity model. Right, you're not defined by who your ancestors are. You're defined by where you live. Right, and if you all live in America, then you better have Minhag America, whatever that is. And if you all live in Israel, Minhag Israel. Or you want to say it goes by cities? Fine. Right, Minhag Modi'in. Right, but that's not what people do. Right, you have one Taimani living in a otherwise completely Ashkenazi community. Right, that Taimani will scream if anybody tries to challenge the Minhagim. My Minhagim go back thousands of years, you Ashkenazim are upstarts, right? Like, you know, I love talking to Temanim and to right, Syrians and Egyptians will be like, my family was in, I remember the person in charge of Sephardi something in YU, He's like, I am 82nd generation, right? My family was the first generation who left Egypt. You know, Egypt, my family can trace their lineage back from the time of Shlomo HaMelech of Syria. His wife was Egyptian, he was Syrian. And he was like, literally, they have documents proving that they moved to Syria in the time of Shlomo HaMelech and have been there straight for thousands of years, right? They were like the first generation to leave. You're not telling me how to change my customs, right? They're like the shul in Syria that we went to in Syria was built by Yoav ben Tsruya when David HaMelech conquered Syria. Do I know that's true? No. The fact that I can't prove it's not true is quite striking. But how did that happen, right? How did we all take this as a given. And it's not just us. You look at the same poskim, right? The same poskim who, and let me just make this point, and this is where I'm stuck a little bit, that the same poskim who say that family menagim are not binding will say, but menag svarad, menag ashkenaz are binding, right? Rav Avadia Yosef will say, parental menagim are not binding, but he'll say, svaradim have to follow the Beit Yosef always, right? Now, admittedly, that's from a second model, which, as I mentioned, is the Rashba. So let's just look at it. That the Rashba comes up with this category that, in addition to what we call minag, this notion of mara da'atra can be expanded beyond geography. And he writes that based on this model, just look at the bold in 17. Umin aderech hazeh kol shenagu la'asod kol ma'asem al pi achad migdolei haposkim. Makom shenagu la'asod kol ma'asem al pi al-chodah Rav Afazi zechono lebracha. That based on these models of Mardatra, that can be exchanged for geography, and you can accept, you know, these communities who no longer follow their own rabbi, they follow the Rambam, they follow the Rif, they follow Shulchan Aruch. Now, to be fair, that Rashba is still only half of an expansion. It expands the notion of Mardatra, meaning the rabbi can be virtual, the authority can be virtual, but not that the community that's accepting that authority is not geographic, right? He's talking about a geographic community that accepts the Rambam. But this quickly becomes, if you look at the Urim V'Tumim, you look by time you get to Rav Avadia Yosef or Moshe Feinstein, etc., this becomes that you are bound. Svaradim have to follow Svaradim Minagim and Ashkenazim have to follow the Rambam, right? And this just becomes a given. And the question you have to really ask is, when did that happen? How did that happen? What is the model that dictates this? Yeah.
A lot of people don't like to think of their lives as being governed like strictly by halacha, and like minhagim are what creates a personal significance for like so many people to Judaism. So if you like, I don't know, if you like try to like take that away from people, like, a lot.
Good. So the answer might be that right now let's set up our options now. Okay, let's set up our options. Given that there is a good argument that can be made in the halachic sources that minhag classically really was geographic and not family, and given, one second, let's just help on the problem. And given the reality that most of us exist as if minhag eda exists, we treat ourselves like Ashkenazim, Sephardim, and the like. So, what moves could we make now? Right, we have several options. Right, we could. Right, let's outline the options. Option one is to say, despite the fact that it's a minority position, that minhagim follow the family line, maybe, despite the fact that that wasn't the majority view throughout Jewish history, that's what we follow. Okay? Second halachic model is to invent a category, which is to say that there is something in between minhag makom and minhag mishpacha, called minhag eda, which, while family minhagim may not be binding, maybe there is an ethnic group thing which is binding in halacha, and then we're going to have to justify that, right? The third model is, what's the third model? Since you're suggesting it, what's the third model? No. What did you just say? What you just said is the third model. Because? Yeah, the third model is to say, look, maybe it's not halachically binding, but that doesn't mean it's meaningless. Right? Either because kibra va'aim would be one model to put it under, or what you said is in fact what the Maritz Chiyut said. Ritzvi Hirsch Chayis, who is fascinating, he is the only person in the Gemara, who's printed in the standard Vilna Shas, who had a doctorate. Right, who had a PhD, Rabbi, doctor. Tzvi Hirsch. Chayes writes this in his Darkei Harah. There's a fascinating, if you ever want to know about Maariv Chayes, there's an excellent dissertation written on it by Bruria Huttner, or Huttner's daughter. An excellent, excellent dissertation. It's available online by the Maariv Chayes. He argues that, yeah, the reason that minhag is so important halacha is not per se the formal component of it. It's because the average person, their relationship to Judaism is more about custom or what they do than what is halachic, right? They don't know the difference. And what? Correct. Therefore, his suggestion is the following. He's not yet talking about what I'm talking about, but he's talking about minhag in general. And his suggestion is as follows. Let's say you have a minhag that's just stupid. Right, it has no halakhic basis whatsoever. It's not usur, it's just stupid. So what should you do? So here's his suggestion. Don't fight it. If people do it, let them do it. Because if you fight people's customs, you will weaken their commitment to Judaism, period. Because people don't necessarily distinguish between real minhagim, fake minhagim. They just don't. But he said, on the other hand, let's say the minhag dies. It just dies. People stop practicing it. Should you fight to revive it? No, let it die, because if what gives custom its importance is the fact that people do it and are connected to it, so while they're connected to it, don't fight it, don't challenge what is meaningful to them. But if it disappears, don't pretend that it's some super halakhic category that you have to reinstate. Now, you could take that type of model and say, look, you're right. Really, truly, deep down, we don't believe that Ashkenazim are Ashkenazim and Sephardim are Sephardim. But if you start challenging Minhagim, right, people are going to lose their identity. But if the reality is that slowly but surely a Israeli identity is emerging that blends a little bit of Ashkenaz and a little bit of Sfarad, or America, or whatever that's truer in Israel than it is in America. So don't fight it. Don't encourage it, don't fight it. Let history, right? Let history take its course, and whatever happens, happens. That would be a third model, which is to say, look, right? So again, the models are, say, you know what? We don't have any tenable explanation for it. Throw it in the garbage, right? Really, we paskin that parental minhagim are not binding. Ethnic minhagim, Ashkenazi minhagim are no different than family minhagim. That halakhic literature says is not binding. Get rid of it, right? That's one model. Other extreme is to paskin and say, no, we follow family minhagim. They really are binding. Third model is to invent a new category, which is to say there's something in between geographic minhagim and family minhagim. Maybe family minhagim per se are not binding, but there's something in between, and we'll see positions like that. And then there's a fourth model, which is to say maybe it's not really binding, but we can accept a middle model, which is to say it's not quite binding, but that doesn't mean it's meaningless. So don't fight people. Allow people to use that as their starting point to orient themselves in Judaism. And if certain minhagim start to blend and certain identities start to fade away and new identities take their place, so let it happen. Right? Let it happen. Yeah. Good. I think you're 100% right. I think you're 100% right. Now, that insight is what lies... I mentioned this position, but since you bring it up, now I'll spell it out. Rav Moshe Feinstein, as I said, argues that a wife has to accept her husband's minhag. His argument is because since the classic minhagim were geographic-based, what could be more geographic than moving into a new home, right? And the wife moves into the husband's home and therefore accepts his minhagim. That's his argument. Rav Henkin responds and says, what are you talking about? There's a machloket in Shulchan Aruch, but machloket Rishonim really, if there's a dispute between a husband and a wife, where they should live, where the wife is from, where the husband is from, who has the upper hand, assuming they bring it to court? I'm not sure that's the best way of resolving it, but let's say they did bring it to court. So who would win? So it's a machloket, so we paskin the wife. So Rav Henkin says, wait a second. Because that's the consensus. That's the consensus view. That's what it is. We can get into that a different time. But he says that's fine. But he says, what does that show you? He said, what is this notion that a woman has to accept her husband's minhagim? The classic minhag halacha is place. And people lived normally where their family was, so there was an overlap. But if you're saying that a woman can force her husband to move to where her family's from, then de facto, she's forcing her husband to accept her minhagim because he's now going to be bound by the minhagim makom, which means that there is no such model that a woman must accept her husband's minhagim, because you see that there's actually models in halacha that tell you the opposite. Now he goes on to say that doesn't mean it's not a good rule of thumb, right? If a woman wants to accept her husband's minhagim, that's fine, right? But she doesn't have to. Now we can take a model like that with minhagei das. We say, like, you know, you want to, you don't want to, whatever, right? It's a good idea for people to keep minhagim. Yeah.
The whole notion that one spouse has to adopt the minhagim of their other spouse, shows how important it is for, like,
sure, but again, I'm not convinced of this, right? And Rav Moshe Feinstein in one place says wives have to take God's minhagim, but then he says that's only minhagim that are family and not just about her. For her, for right, minhagim that only affect the woman, she can take her own minhagim.
It's about things that affect the family. The kids should have to do those things too.
Correct, but my tendency is to think that's more pragmatic, is that you want, right, you don't want complete, right.
Yeah,
that's my tendency to think, and therefore I think it's more about having a single minhag than whose minhag it is, right? I think educationally that's important, right? Right, meaning I don't think it, right, but I tend not to be convinced by the arguments that you have to accept only the husband's minhag. I just think, no, I agree with you.
They should agree on a set of minhagim that shows
that. I agree. People don't like when I say this, or rabbis don't like when I say this. I tend to agree with you. I think that's what the halakhic evidence points to. I'm not convinced by the arguments. Otherwise, I do think that there's a value to having somewhat consensus minhagim within a family. What those minhagim is, I'm less convinced, as you will see in general, by these very firm, you have to follow this. I'm not as convinced. That, by the way, is going to be my conclusion. I'm going to describe what I see, but I'm, right, part of my contention is that these models are being fought out at the moment, because we sort of jumped to an assumption that minhag hamakom can simply be recreated as minhag eda, but I don't know that is 100% legitimate. Okay. So, if you look at 21 and 22, you'll see sort of these minhagim, middle models. Siach Nachum. Anyone know who Siach Nachum is? Rav Nachum Rabinovich, I don't know who that is. The Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Ma'ale Adumim, Yeshivat Birkat Moshe. He is wonderful. For anyone who's, no one's from Toronto, right? We said no one's from Toronto. Well, anyways, for many years he was a rabbi in Toronto. He has his PhD from University of Toronto in Applied Mathematics, Probability in the Talmud. Very complicated book. It's sitting on my shelf at home. My eyes sort of glaze over as I try to read it, but and I do like math, but maybe at some point I'll get through it. Fascinating person. So in his Tshuva Tziach Nachum, he already begins a middle model in terms of minhag avot. And he says, V'chom minhag, kaze tzarech adam l'hitchashev b'mishpachto v'chaveirav. With any custom, you have to take into account your family and your friends. Shelo yeh yoshev ben omdim v'lo omeid ben ha-yoshvim. He uses the halachic phrase, so you aren't standing amongst those sitting or sitting amongst those standing. Ki zenira ki yora omevi l'riv l'azut tzvatayim. Because it will cause fights and for people bad-mouthing each other. Biglal ha-mit en ha-ragshi shebinyan. Because of the emotional components here, the emotional charge in these issues, ani morel lechol shoel lasod kmo sheose aviv, kidei shelo levazot et aviv rachmana letzan. I tell people to follow what their parents do, to not embarrass their parents. Vafilu aviv mochel v'gadol kavod aviv. Right. So he says, look, there is a value to family minhagim, but it's not because it's a binding minhag. It's because there's emotional charge. It causes pain in the family, right? So that's a model, which is to say, you know what, we're not talking classic minhag models, we're talking something else.
Okay.
But that's justifying already family minhag. And it's saying it's not really about minhag, it's about something else, and
okay.
So it's sort of true, sort of not.
That's a different issue.
Correct. It's a different issue. So that's what I said. One issue is, one model is to say, look, this is a different issue, right? To come up with some other model. Now, Rav Vosner, in 22, is aware of this problem. Rav Vosner was a 19th and 20th century posek, and I think an 18th, 19th, and century, or 19th, 20th, and 21st century person. He lived. Sorry, he was 19th, 20th, and 21st century posek. I think he lived over 3 centuries. He died at like, no one's quite sure when he, how old he was when he died, but he died a few years ago. He was anywhere between 104 and 112, which would have placed him as being like born around the time of the McKinley assassination. He lived for a very long time. He was the posek of Bnei Brak, one of the poskim of Bnei Brak, very impressive posek. He deals with this question, and he takes the model of saying, no, it's not about Minhag Avot, this is not, but it is real. So what's his model? His model is to invent a new category, which he calls Minhag HaShevet. That apparently we're just going in the wrong direction here. You're trying to recreate Minhag Avot or Minhag HaMakom. That's not what's going on here. Is that what's emerged is a different category called Shvatim. Maybe you like that better than Eidah, ethnic, whatever you want. But he calls it Shevet. Right? Tribal identity. And that is binding. And that's what he writes. Yislachli. Forgive me that I'm only answering you now. Right, you have Sephardim and Ashkenazi yeshiva, and vice versa. So now they are affected both by their minhag of being a Sephardi or an Ashkenazi and their yeshiva. What do? So he says, "Hine pashut lahalacha." It seems obvious to me, lahalacha. Dafil Ashkenazi hanimtza ligamrei bekahal Sephardim muvhak. V'chein ir shel Sephardim umiut Ashkenazim shein lem kahal uveitin b'fnei atzmam shemiut nimshach achrei arov. It seems obvious to me that an Ashkenazi who is in a Sephardi place or a Sephardi city with a few Ashkenazim and they don't have their own shul, their own community, then the halacha is that what? The minority follows the majority. That's what all the classic halachot are talking about. A few Ashkenazim move into a Sephardi place, they got to keep the new minhagim. That's what we're talking about. And the other way around. And he says that even if eventually, the Ashkenazim were to outpace the Sephardim. If they came in one at a time and became Sephardi, right, one at a time, so then, they, even by the end, it happens to be more Ashkenazim, doesn't matter, the Sephardi minhag would overpower.
But if they all come at the same time?
Okay. So then he says, skip down. Let's see. Skip down to Vahageder Hazeh. Right, 4 paragraphs in the bottom. Vahageder Hazeh pi Tshuvat Hagaon Zichron Yosef. Which is quoted in Pitchei Tshuvah, which we saw. Te'ein ha-ben mechuyav l'nhok avotav zulam im hergiluhu avotav v'nei king. He said, look, we know, we rule that fundamentally a parent's minhag isn't binding on their child unless the child accepted it himself. He said the consensus, psak, I have to agree, is that parental minhagim are not binding per se. Right? They're binding if the child chooses to follow them, but they're not fundamentally binding. Aval, he said, but that's not what we're talking about here. Davar shekibel alatzmo shevet shalem bechal Yisrael. But if there's not a family minhag, but it's a tribe, so then k'mo minhag heya svaradim v'achrodeem b'bnei shehem svaradim, like Sephardi positions because they are Sephardi. V'nimshechu acharei rabotam ze kama meot shanim meot b'shana, and they've been following this tribal position for hundreds of years. V'chein achraot shel Ashkenazim k'rama. And similar to the Rama, shezet davar nimshach ledorot olam mikama meot shana. Bazen yired lo tzarich kabbalah mishegdil the shorish shivto mimela michuyav lenhog kavotav. Then you don't need to accept it anew. You are bound by virtue of the fact that you are part of this tribe. So here is the models we have so far. Okay, classic minhag. Majority view is that geography is the defining characteristic. Minority view is that family minhagim are binding. What do you do in a modern reality when
Right? How do you justify the modern reality that now we have this middle category called Eida, Shevet, whatever you want to call it, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, whatever you want to call it. Okay? So what models do we have available to us? So, model one is to say that despite the fact this was the minority view, we in fact think that family minhagim are binding. This is Rebbe Yashe. Okay? Opposite extreme would be to say, nope, nowadays there's just no binding minhagim. Get over it. Right? We don't live in that world. This is all one big mistake. Okay? Middle model is to say there's a middle type of category, Eida or Shevet. This is the Shevet Alevi, Rav Buzner. Which is to say, this is why in our modern world we treat this as important, because this is a different category called Eida. Alternatively, is to say, another middle category would be to say, it's a quasi-minhag, right? It's not really binding, right? But we treat it as binding, either because Amar Tzchias type argument, which is, look, don't shake people's traditions, right? Don't shake people's faith, right? Don't shake people's commitments, or really their faith, based on commitment. Just don't do it. It's a bad idea. Right? Meaning this is, we treat it as if this exists, or some sort of kibbut avim model. But it's not really what it looks like, and therefore, if it morphs, so let it morph. Right? So let it morph.
Minutes. Okay. Very quickly, let me summarize for you Rabbi Lam's article, which I'm not going to read all of it. Right? I'm not going to read all of it, but I gave it to you. Rabbi Lam was asked this in the 70s, I think. Let me summarize it for you outside. Okay? It's really an excellent article. It's worth reading. But so that we only take 2 weeks on this topic and not three. Right? I will summarize this article. Next week, we'll read the sources where I argue that. Right, so far I've argued this is basically a 20th century problem. What I want to do next week is show you that I'm not sure that what I just said is true, and I've become convinced that this problem is older than I have admitted in the past, and I want to explain why I think that's true, and then we can... It's an open question of what the implications of that are. What?
How old are we assuming he is right now?
So, I always thought that basically this was a modern phenomenon, right? 20th century. Because I figured that, you know, right, it was only after the total upheaval of the world where millions of people, right, meaning maybe it started a bit earlier, maybe 19th century, 19th. What we're going to see is that that's only somewhat true. There are hints that this started to become an issue in the 16th century.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Like, anytime after the Middle Ages, basically, it seems like it would make sense.
Correct. So there is some evidence of that, and we're gonna see that. I still think it's mostly a modern phenomenon, but...
Well, all our problems are now mostly modern.
Yes, that is definitely true. Okay, so Rabbi Lam was asked this question. This is how it came up, okay? Rabbi Lam wrote an article in Beit Yitzchak, Beis Yitzchak. It's,
okay.
It is called Beis Yitzchak. It's the YU journal. I had the unfortunate experience of being the editor of that for several years.
That's unfortunate,
yes, it's... Painful.
Is that not what you wanted?
No, I got bullied into it. Do you know how hard it is to edit over 700 pages of badly written... Not everyone knows how to write Hebrew well, so some of it was well written, but of that 700 pages, many hundreds of pages were not well written. Torah, Chidushim, it was painful. What? Well, look, it was... Look, when you open it up to everybody, so some of them are going to be good, some of them are bad, first you have to sift through the good and the bad, and then you have to choose what you publish, and even that you have to edit and copy edit, and the Rosh Yeshiva always want to put in articles, but they didn't necessarily get the memo about deadlines, so you have to chase them down. There's a lot of work that goes into it, and part of it was fun. I'm glad that's behind me. So he wrote an article about naming children after live people. Okay? Which, as we know, Svardim do and Ashkenazim don't. Okay, that's basically what it is. Rabbi Lam in that article suggested that, well, look, if an Ashkenazi wants to do it, let him do it. Because maybe it's not really binding after the Shoah, because we're not really Ashkenazim. That was his suggestion. Suggestion. Someone responded to...
What is the timeline of the Shoah have to do with whether or not we're...
Meaning he's saying... I don't... He opened up the possibility. He said, maybe there is an Ashkenazi minhag, but are we really Ashkenazim?
Because we don't live in Europe, is that what...
Yeah, exactly. Meaning post-Shoah, we just call ourselves Ashkenazim, but we're American. Right? That's his argument. And there was a response. Someone wrote to him and said, how dare you? Right? How dare you say that? Because if you're saying that, yes, this is a minor minhag. I mean, Rav had two prongs. One is this is not such a strong minhag to begin with. The second one is I'm not convinced that Ashkenaz Sfarad really exists. And this person yelled at him and said, are you out of your mind? Right? Are you telling me that Ashkenazim are allowed to eat tidnia? Right? That was what he said. Right?
Yes, they can.
Right? Right? That's what he says. Mutar levnei Ashkenaz lachol kidnia bepesach v'chadomeh. So, I love Rabbi Lam, I really do. So look at the article, right? This is the summary. That was the summary in this middle paragraph, right, where Rabbi Lam tells you how this article came into being. And he writes as follows. L'chvod yedidi hana'ale Rav Gaon Rav Avram Shlita Shlomcha Yizge. Right, he's very polite, right? He said, please, right? My dear friend, I read your article. So look at the last paragraph in this page. Yurshali liachiradi bral bikarda ikarit shebimichtavcha. Let me speak about your fundamental critique. Hainu kushiyotcha sheim kederechavot yair sheveiti shemakom gorein linan minhag. He said, you challenged me because I said, basically the argument that we've said. I actually came up with this before I saw Rabbi Lam's article, so I was very happy to see that Rabbi Lam wrote this, and it gave me confidence what I was saying. He said, you said that if in fact that I'm right, that we paskin, that parental menhagim are not binding, v'shekilot ashkenaz behen itpatecha menhag shelo legreid avlad, al shem adam chai v'davon nafsho lo nishar behen saridu palim v'nei amenu, and therefore, now that we don't live in Ashkenaz anymore, so this minhag doesn't really apply. So you said, are you willing to take the consequences of this and say that Ashkenazi doesn't exist? We can eat kidniot. Right? You said to me, everyone acts as if they're Ashkenazim, if they're Svardim. Are you really telling me that this doesn't exist? He says, Hine yafeh ha'arta. He said, good point. Avaloa light tlunatcha kimal chavod yair. Said, you're right. It's a good point. But you're not challenging me. You're challenging all of those poskim who in fact said that yes, that the minag category of minag and halacha is place and not family. Velo rakalav el gamori vashmenu shavi kardato bazev alaran. Says, not just chavod yair. He said, you're challenging everybody. But this is the simplest understanding of the entire tradition that we have about Minhagim. Yes. He said, yes, you are correct. This is the Chora Kushyatsumav. He said, you have asked a good question which has no good solution. He said, Ubiri Shonachi Khanu Lavin. Eich Milchatchila Chaluf Elacha Kol Minhagei Edot Acharem Yotzei Chalatzeim. He said, you're right. You're asking a very good question. How did this happen? That people started treating themselves as if they have the Minhagim of their places of origin. Such that Ashkenazim treat Ashkenazim in argument, Svardim in Temanim. Hello, Ef Sharlomar Shish Lam Din Shall Stam Ear, Sharbe Arim Vayarot, Krachim Kfarim, Shamrumasar Eda Zu Ozu Velo Shayach, Choralag Dirang of an Ear, Shim Mugdaram Kamakom Misuyam. He said, you can't tell me they're a place. They're not a place. They're not a place, yeah. Yes. Yep. And he says, I mean, look, that's what he says. He says, where did this come from? That you have to follow it. Said, and then he adds that the historians think that Ashkenazi Menagim are more Israeli, originally Eretz Israel, Menag Sfarad, Bavel, okay. We have to look at the halachic background for this assumption in America. So Rabbi Lehem thinks this is a modern problem, right? The 20th century problem. He says, this is a unique American problem, or Israeli problem, or 20th century problem, because there's been mass immigration, right? There was never a time in history where literally all of Jewry just scattered from their original places and recongregated in new countries that quickly. That's true. It's never happened to that scale. He said, we really had two different options. We could have theoretically ended up in a situation where we created one universal minhag. That could have been what happened. That could have been the result of globalization. That we become one global Jewish community. But that's not what happened. People remain groups. Zer sham, zer sham, a little bit here, a little bit there. Shem shichu et haminhagim shel arzot motzam v'arei pizureim v'lod mazgu l'kila achad v'aflo birachad. Rather than creating one national or even one citywide minhag. This is what happened. Ukshem shivanu chaneser bilbelet umot kach bo amot l'amerika v'yifrika b'neihem. He said, just like the Nebuchadnezzar confused all the generations, right? All the peoples, the people came to America, and this is just what happened, right? We became these disparate groups within one geographic place. Uvarush amitziot amerikait hikach she'in lerot barim shelanu et emtzei adarush lamshich masoret kilatit. And it's clear that in the American context, we can't just create these great kilot. So he says, how did this happen? So then he goes on, and he says, well, there's geography. Right, he goes through different models. So skip to the next paragraph. He says, there are two ways to understand what happened here. Said one option is really to reject this and say, really, you're right. Geography is only binding in geographic places, and that's it. We could take that direction, and he says I can prove that from the fact that so much of halacha emphasizes the poskim b'she'arecha, right, in your gates, in your city, right? There is just so much geography talk. Maybe that's really what we meant. In which case, there are no minhagim anymore. He said, and maybe the Minhage Ashkenaz originally were just an extrapolation of this, and saying geography won't be judged by city, it'll be judged by huge geographic region. But if that was what you thought happened, that Minhag Ashkenaz and Sfarad originally were just an expansion of Makom from a city to a country, and from a country to a continent, so then you're right. Nowadays there would be no Minhag. However, it's possible that this is not the case. And he suggests a new model. He says the second would be to say that this is mishpachot. Right? You could say that this is an expansion of minag mishpacha with all the problems that come with it. So then he comes up, but I have a third suggestion. He says maybe the following. In the time of Chazal, there was some evidence of minhag which are not just geography based, and that's what were called the economic guilds. The economic guilds. You could have the carpenter guild that would impose customs of practice in their city. So Rabbi Lam suggests, he says, maybe this proves that there is precedent in halacha for buy-in. For buy-in. Right? For optional buy-in. Because you identify. Now, this is hard because that's really a financial model. right? Carpenters in a particular city accepted it to be part of the guild, so you have it. But he said, maybe we can talk about that. If I belong to a shul, I buy into that guild, and maybe there's a similar model for minog. And maybe that's what B'nai Eidah is. And he says, therefore, maybe it's not just Eidot, but maybe that's why you can be bound by your shul minhagim, or something like that. So he says in page 7, that's what he suggests. Ashal kainin ilatsiya, and this is his model. He said, my model is the following. Shemechivan shebar soda brit lo yitachin l'gaber al arim ulai b'tokev minaginu ayom b'alite b'te k'nesiyot b'te midrashot kolel yeshivot v'chaserot ad morim. Maybe our minhagim come from shuls and yeshivot and chasidish groups. U'mikoach b'nei umanut, from the model established from the economic guilds, Sharei ha'avdel ben ir lamanut u she'ir mugderet kemakom v'ilamanut u lefi tiv'a mugderet kekvutza hitnadvutit. In English, voluntary association. Right? He says maybe in America the model is that we learn from B'nai Umanut that you can create minhagim based on voluntary association. And maybe that is why minhagim are binding. That is his suggestion for a new model. Now he says, I'm not really convinced that this is true, right? But this is his suggestion. Now, I would suggest reading the article if you get the time, but let me point out some of the points that Ray Lam hints at that I think are very powerful. I'm not convinced by his model per se, right? Because it really is an economic model. But I'll tell you what I am convinced of. Ray Lam says, why does he go in this model? The reason he goes in this direction is because, if I asked you the honest question, which is how many of you, or how many of your, do you think your parents, want to give up on the notion that they're Ashkenazi or Sephardi? Right, how many people want to? The answer is that most people don't. When do people like this shear? When do people jump on this shear when I say maybe this is all a mistake? Kitnya, right? They have certain minhagim they don't like, right? And then they say, oh, it can't be binding. But if I ask most people, do you really want to give up all of your identity, right? Do you really want to start from scratch and have to justify yourself every time you rely on a kula of the Rama and eat at a restaurant in America that doesn't have a Jew lighting the that doesn't have a Jew cooking, but only had a Jew lighting the flame, right? Do you want to start from scratch? Do you want to start from scratch when you figure out what you're supposed to do at your Seder? Right? Do you want to start from scratch? What will they tell me 90% of the time?
No.
No, that's not what I want to do. There's certain minhagim I don't like, but if I had to do it again, I basically would continue identifying as I identify. So I think Rabbi Lam is a fair description of what has happened, right? Which is that people, in the end of the day, don't really want to give up on identity. They want to be part of Ashkenazim, Sephardim, whatever. They just, right? And yeah, there are things that they don't like. But you know what? That's life, right? Sometimes you move into a city because you like it 90% of what happens there, and 10% you swallow because you live there. I think Rabbi Lam is right descriptively that that's how people treat minhagim, right? Is that fundamentally they really do want to be part of an identity group. They just, right? They don't love everything about it, so, you know, when it comes to those things, they jump on it. Again, is this a halachic model? I'm not convinced. But maybe this is one of those middle models, which is to say, look, as a starting point, as a rule of thumb, maybe we're sort of Ashkenazim, right? It's our minhag to treat ourselves as if we're Ashkenazim and Sephardim and whatever. A middle model like that, though, if you assume it's not a formal model, right? Ray Lam suggests it's a formal model, though he's not convinced. But if you say, no, it's not necessarily a formal model, but it's a good description of what we do, then maybe the halachic result will be, barring extenuating circumstances, you should act as an Ashkenazi. But let's say someone really doesn't want to. They want to become Sephardi, right? Would you say it's legitimate?
Yeah.
Yeah, right? So those are, I think, the models that we have, right? So we have the models to say this is binding, either because all family minhagim are binding, or we think there's a category called Eidah HaShevet, Rebbe Eliashiv, or you're convinced by Ari Lam that we have basically become part of a voluntary association that's binding based on minhag umanut, right? Minhagei umanut and the like,
Or you take some sort of middle model, which is say, no, we sort of, we treat it as a starting point, either because we keep it off aim, or because we don't want to shake people's faith, or because that's really what we want to do. Right? It's not 100% binding. We understand that there might be distinctions, and we'll flesh out the details when it comes to that, but we'll act as if that's where we exist. Or, theoretically, you could say, no, we really reject it. Those are the models that are live. The reality of the way Jews live is that we live somewhere in the middle. Right? Is that either we accept this as binding, or at least as our starting point. What I want to do next week is show that this is not completely a new issue. It is maybe exacerbated by the 20th century, but it's not completely new. And like I said, I don't have firm answers. Right? And what I tell people is that, look, this is my description of what has happened. I cannot promise you that in 20 years, the community will not decide, you know what, we really aren't Ashkenazi anymore. And as I said, in Israel, you see the beginnings of this, that people are less and less convinced, and minhagim are blending, and what that'll lead to in 20 years, and whether descriptively this will be true, right? I think these will be the potential models. Whether descriptively it'll be true that most people want to stay in this Eidah Shevet model, I don't know. But this is the halachic problem. Like I said, I'm being honest with you, and I'm not sure that this is the right or only halachic conclusion that we could have reached, or even the one that we will continue to reach in the future. This is just my description of the models that could have emerged and the ones that did. Yeah. Last question, and then we'll see the next week. We'll just, you know, you can read the Rabbi Lam's article, but I'm going to focus on the pages that start with Mazda Ashkenazi, where I point out that this is not completely new, that this did begin in the begin earlier, and see what that might tell us about these halachot. Yeah.
Are you assuming, though, that you have to choose between Ashkenazi and like Sfarad? Because, like,
no, I'm just using that, as opposed to like Minhag Teiman, or...
Or could you just like make your own, like your...
Again, so I think that if you, definitely if you think this is a mistake, you could choose your own Minhagim, and even if you're in the middle, right, you could say, look, for most people there's a starting point, but if it becomes the fact that there isn't such a starting point, then yeah, you could change it. And that's going to be, this is where things are going to get more malleable in this middle category. But we'll flesh it out a bit more next week. Like I said, I think this is one of the most important issues that is under-discussed in modern halachic literature, but we'll come back to it next week, okay?